some serious expressions of appreciation to the folks here at Schertz. This is the second lectureship you've hosted. The first one, you wouldn't know but what you hadn't done it for a number of years. It was excellent. This year, certainly excellent. Your hospitality is great. And I don't know but what some of the rest of us who work with lectureships are going to have to try to come up with something comparable to that brown bag that you gave us. That was truly nice. It did take me a while to get all that body butter off myself this morning in the shower. But I'll tell you what, you put that right on, you slip right out of bed. That just works. Seriously, I do appreciate those kindnesses. That was very nice. When I got here, got the brown sack as I was coming in, just as Tyler Young was preaching, and I said, well, they know how long he preaches. I thought it was a sack lunch, you know. So anyway, about the time he was thinking about slowing down, I started looking in that sack to see if there was something to eat. I have to confess this too, and I mean this again sincerely. Whoever, and if you want to remain anonymous, that's fine, but I would appreciate knowing, but whoever you are that provided the lunch for the speakers in this lectureship, thank you. That was very kind and certainly most appreciated. Studies in difficult passages. That's a tremendous work in a lectureship book. And certainly in the Bible, again, there are numbers of difficult passages. And we would readily say that no one would say that he knows all that the Bible has to teach on every detail, especially when it comes to minutia. But at the same time, if we will study and learn how to use hermeneutics correctly, many of those passages which seem so difficult will have solutions if we will apply ourselves. And I would encourage you to please read the lectureship book when it comes to other matters I have to say along those lines. But having said that, I must also say that there is a difference between exegesis and eisegesis. And folks, there's a whole lot of eisegesis going on in the pulpits and in the studies being done in the world today. And what that means is a lot of people are reading into the Scriptures things that are not there. And as preachers, we are to be exegetes, and that means we extract or take from the Scriptures that which is there. And one of those areas, the second point that I will deal with this afternoon, is an area where there has been a great deal of eisegesis, and I want to say to you, I think some of it is dishonest. It is an attempt to rest the Scriptures, to have the Scriptures say something that those who are resting them want the Scriptures to say, but which is entirely and directly contradictory to what the Bible teaches on that point. The first issue or question that I'm to deal with is, how many times did God give the law of Moses? And I point out in the lectureship book that if you look at the Scriptures that have been cited for me to deal with, such as Exodus 20, Exodus 24, Exodus 31, Exodus 33, and Exodus 34, you would say that there would be at least four, possibly five different times that the law was given. And we can say that when it comes to aspects of the law, there were multiple givings of that law. But if you look, first of all, and this was brought out last night, and I appreciate the words that were spoken, the first time in Exodus chapter 20 that the law is issued forth from God, it is issued forth from the standpoint of a public, that is to all the people, at one time by God directly. He spake what was said in that regard. And as the point was made last night, there were so many things that were accompanying that presentation that the children of Israel feared. They saw the mountain quake, they saw the smoke, they heard the thunder. There was all kinds of manifestation of the power, the greatness, the magnitude of God, and these people were scared. And they appealed to Moses, and he then becomes their mediator. But I'd like to show you that from the standpoint of what the Scriptures teach. First of all, notice in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 17, it's here that God first presents what we call the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments. He does so orally, he does so directly, and it is not through Moses, but again, publicly, directly, from God to the people. Later, following this particular presentation, God instructs Moses regarding these matters, "Thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, ye yourselves have seen that I have talked with you, the people, from heaven." And then, of course, in Exodus 20 and verse 1, going back up to that, God spake all these words, saying. That introduces the giving of the Decalogue in Exodus chapter 20. When you see what transpires as these people seek Moses to be their mediator, you find that he does just that. And in Exodus chapter 24, verses 4 and 7, we read that this is the book of the covenant. This book, as you see in chapters 21, 22, and 23, this book of the covenant is what is presented there. And this was read then to all the people, and they responded, "All that Jehovah hath spoken, we will do, and be obedient." Notice that reference in Exodus 24 and verse 7. Now, the reason that I've emphasized this as I have is to show that to this point in time, nothing is said about Moses giving the law to the people. So when you go to the original question, how many times did God give Moses the law, we would not include this time, since God did not give it just to Moses, but in fact had given it to all the people. Then, of course, it does come through Moses as a mediator, and then we go on to see more about that. In Exodus chapter 21, for example, verses 1 through 18, and certainly time doesn't permit us to read that passage, but in that passage, we see a ratification of the aforementioned covenant that's found in Exodus chapter 24. And so, we say, it is not until Exodus 24 and 12 that God said unto Moses, "Come up to me into the mount and be here or there, and I will give thee the tables of stone and the law and the commandment which I have written, that thou mayest teachest them." And then it says, on this occasion, Moses was on the mount for 40 days, as you can see in verse 18. What was revealed to Moses during this time is covered, and you can find this, in Exodus chapters 25 through 33. So that's the way the chapters break down. When you come to chapter 31, you'll notice something particular with reference to verse 18. Whereas God had previously given the Decalogue orally to the children of Israel in general, this time at the end of the 40 days, Moses here on Mount Sinai is given the law by God, the Decalogue this time written in stone, and it is written by God. Exodus chapter 31 verse 18 states, "And he gave unto Moses, when he had made an end of communicating with him upon Mount Sinai, the two tables of the testimony, tables of stone written with the finger of God." And again, Moses gives this to the mediator. God gives this to the mediator, Moses, then to deliver to the people. Unfortunately, while Moses is on the mount these 40 days, the children of Israel return to their evil and idolatrous ways. They get Aaron, the brother of Moses, to make the graven image, the golden calf, and they would bow down to that calf. In so doing, they violate, as we would say it, the first four of those commandments found in the Decalogue. There, as we read them, "I am Jehovah thy God, who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." Chapter 20 and verse 2. "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." Exodus 20 and verse 3. "Thou shalt not make unto thee a graven image, nor any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth." Exodus 20 and verse 4. And the fourth point is, "Thou shalt not bow down thyself unto them, nor serve them, for I, Jehovah, thy God, am a jealous God." Exodus 20 and verse 5. Now, ignoring all of these, which they had initially heard God himself give them, And as we look further into these matters, their understanding should have been that they knew that these were violations of that law that God had given them. We find that they do just that. That's a violation to these points. Look with me at Exodus 32, verses 1 through 4. But I want to look specifically, if I may, at this line, these words that they themselves uttered. These, speaking of the golden calf and evidently other gods, these are thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Now, can you imagine what a blasphemy this is? It was God who brought them out of the land of Egypt. And we pointed out in a Wednesday night study not long ago, as the children of Israel had been gathered to leave Egypt and the bondage that they were under there, they came to the Red Sea, and the Red Sea was before them, mountains on either side of them, and Pharaoh's army behind them. And I asked the question, how did God save them on that occasion? And the answer, of course, and a correct answer it is he parted the sea and they walked across. But I said, that's right, but he did so by what? Grace. They certainly had to walk across. They had to comply with God's will, but he provided the means of their salvation. He did for them that which they could not do for themselves. And certainly God has done for us in the spiritual realm what we cannot do for ourselves by providing through his mediator, Jesus Christ, also his sacrifice in our behalf. By grace, you and I may be saved the bondage to sin and go across, if we may, into the spiritual realm, entering the state known as the church. Well, these people insult God. That violates the covenant. Now, Brother Ken will tell you that once a covenant or agreement or contract has been violated, it makes it what? Null and void if the violated party so desires. That's why you have in marriage that contract. If that person who is what we typically refer to as the innocent party, that party has, of course, had the contract, the covenant violated, and if he or she so wishes, that marriage can be scripturally terminated, and they then can marry someone else. That could have been the case with God. And as a matter of fact, in his first approach to Moses, basically that's what he says. He says, Moses, I'm just going to destroy them. And then we'll bring about salvation through you. Of course, as a mediator, Moses pleads the case for them. Petitions God, if you will, not to do those very things. And yet, when Moses goes down to deal with them, he himself shows his displeasure to the people. Well, in the fourth point, we can see in Exodus chapter 33, verses 1 through 23, that there is neither a restating or a renewing of the law. Rather, it shows the necessity or the prerequisites, if you will, for Israel, that which they had to meet, in order for a reinstatement of the law to be done. And as you read in this, you can see that God's already destroyed, or rather has decided not to destroy the Israelites. However, through Moses, he's going to and does express his displeasure, and he has as his design to bring them to repentance. Now, notice this in the book, and you might want to underline this point. If there was to be a renewed covenant relationship between God and Israel, it meant starting all over. And that's exactly what happens. Now, noticing the fifth scripture given, Exodus 34, 1 through 35. Jehovah said unto Moses, hew thee two tables of stone like unto the first, and I will write upon the tables the words that were on the first tables which thou breakest. This is verse 1. Now, the first time, God himself had provided the stones and done the writing on those stones, giving that Decalogue, the Decalogue that way. But this, by the way, which is the third time that the Decalogue is given, the first time orally, the second two times written, this time Moses has to provide the stones. And you might notice, too, from Exodus chapter 34, verses 2 and 4, that Moses, again, has to go up to Mount Sinai. And once there, God commands Moses, write thou these words, for after the tenor of these words, I have made a covenant with thee and with Israel, reinstating the covenant. And he was there with Jehovah 40 days and 40 nights. He did neither eat bread nor drink water. And you can read the rest. Thus God has renewed that Decalogue and certainly the covenant that he had with Israel. Now, the second of those questions that I'm to deal with, does God or does the law concerning injury to a pregnant woman justify abortion? You know, at first glance, you would say there's no reason for anybody to believe that anybody, especially if they claim to be intelligent, would think that Exodus or anywhere else in the Bible, you would find justification for abortion. Let's read the verses together, talk about exegesis and eisegesis briefly, if we may. In verses 22 through 25, we read, "And if men strive together and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart, and yet no harm follow, he shall be surely fined, according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe." You look at that particular passage and you have to conclude two things. These two things are, first of all, abortion is not even a part of what's being discussed. And secondly, the word harm in this passage has to do with injury or death suffered as the result of an accident. There has never been an abortion performed in abortion clinics that's an accident. That's why they're in business. And that's to make money, and again, that takes accidental death out of the picture. It's talking about, number one, an injury. Number two, an injury which has been the result of an accident. Abortion is not just an injury. And abortion, again, as we see it in our modern context, is certainly no accident. But some resort not to exegesis, but to eisegesis in using this particular reference. They want to put abortion into it, if not explicitly, at least implicitly. Kate, a commentator, opines, quote, "The laws regarding miscarriage imply nothing concerning the personhood of the unborn fetus." Now, when you're talking about pro-life and pro-death, pro-abortion, when that word fetus is used, it's used by those who are pro-abortion because they want to dehumanize and impersonalize the baby. That's why they use that word. Now, I will agree that as a medical term, as a stage of development, it's certainly a term that is applicable. But that term is used, again, not for the reasons of describing the biological development of a child, but rather to dehumanize it, to impersonalize it. Doesn't it sound a whole lot better to say we aborted a fetus than it does to say we aborted a baby? You know it does, and I do too. Well, again, he goes on. He says, "The punishment stated here was based upon injury to the woman, not to the fetus. The fine was to be suggested by the husband, but it must be approved by the judges." End of quote. Now let's do just a brief amount of reasoning. If you reason from such a position, you're going to be forced to conclude that injury to the baby or even the baby's death does not matter to God. Moreover, the implication of such a stance is that while the life of the mother is of value, the life of the baby has no value. And to such thinking, other commentators, such as to such things as this by Cole, as a response, are given. Cole responds, "It has sometimes been claimed by those in favor of abortion that the unborn child is not really considered as an individual here." And certainly that's the case with Kate. Now, I want to say something. I've got to be real careful. Kate, that I'm quoting in the book, C-A-T-E, that's not an error. And I certainly wouldn't want anybody to confuse this one with Brother Kate's, Brother Curtis Kate's, please. I was afraid of that when I sent in the manuscript, but this is a different person. Brother Curtis Cates wouldn't agree with Kate at all regarding these matters. But anyway, as Cole continues, he says, "The destruction of the unborn child was regarded by the Hebrews as an instance of the most barbarous cruelty, calling down God's judgment." And then he quotes 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 16, which of course is true. God has never looked over the death of a child, whether you're talking about the death of an unborn child or one that has been born. And this needs to be understood, since a significant focus of Exodus 21, 22 through 25 is upon the premature delivery of a woman's child. The word harm must be applied to the child even equally as well to the mother, or as well to the mother. Otherwise, there would be absolutely no need to mention her pregnancy or the premature birth of her child. If you're just talking about a woman and the harm that befalls her, why bring up the idea of the loss of a child? Meaningless at all. And then, furthermore, the prescribed penalties are to be adjudicated according to the severity of the injuries incurred by the mother and or her child. Yet disregarding the specific punishment laid down in the passage, that is, life for a life, there is disagreement still over whether capital punishment could be rendered if the baby is killed. Here's what I'm saying there. There are those who would say that the baby is a living being. It is a human. Its life is certainly to be protected, and God would not have an abortion performed at all. But they will say from this passage, and again using eisegesis, I would say, are saying that the life of the mother, if she is killed, would bring about life for life, capital punishment. But if the baby's life is taken and not the mother's, then it would not be a capital offense or life for life offense. Now, these two views are argued even among our brethren. I would say to you that in any way that you would devalue the life of the fetus, you then have fallen into the grasp of the logic and the reasoning that's used by the abortionist. Some say, again, it's not a capital offense. It's argued that since Exodus 21, 22 through 25 is discussing an accident, and we all should agree that it is, then if the accident not only caused the miscarriage, but also the death of the child, only a fine, they say, was imposed. Now, how you break down the situation like that, I'd have to leave to somebody else. There is no way I can see in the Scriptures that we would be justified in breaking these things down, except to the degree of the injuries that are involved. Well, then again, you have that idea being expressed by such men as Alsobrook. He writes, "True, if a man accidentally struck a pregnant woman while fighting with her husband and she miscarried, he was not to be put to death. Yet he was fined according to whatever her husband determined." See Exodus 21, 22 through 25. "This was not because a life had not been lost, but because two men were involved and the miscarriage was an unintentional result." Well, that's interesting. I couldn't help but ask the question, where did Alsobrook get the idea that the woman's husband was one of those who caused the accident? You talk about eisegesis. I didn't see anything indicated in the verse as to whom those who performed the act or gotten into the scuffle that caused the accident. I didn't see that either of those were her husband. Again, I think that is a part of the reasoning that people do to try to justify a position. But his position is, kill the mama, life for life. Kill the baby, just a fine. Capital punishment. again, would be the rule in the case of the death of the mother, but not the child. And Moffat shows how this works, how the idea is expressed. He says in Exodus 21, 22 through 25, if a man hurts a woman so that she has a miscarriage, he's fine. But if the woman dies, it's eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. So the argument goes that a child is less than a person, for the punishment is less for a babe in the womb. However, in Exodus 21, 21 through 25, if a man killed a servant, he would merely be punished. Is the servant less than a person? Two, when a person accidentally killed another, he was not put to death. One who attacked a woman was and caused a miscarriage was not making a direct assault on the child, so it would not call for the death penalty. Now, there was a little confusion on my part, still is, about what all Brother Moffat was saying, but I do know from this that he was saying that you can have a full-grown servant out here, a full-grown man. And if his death is brought about, there's a fine imposed there. Is that one any less of a person than the owner of him as his master? Of course not. Well, again, the argument continues. If you've been keeping up with the news, you know that in the Peterson case, there were two verdicts rendered. First-degree murder for Lacey, the mother. Second-degree murder for Connor, the child. And the way that it's thought as these things are pursued is the direct action was performed against the mother and the death of the child was a secondary result and therefore a second-degree verdict, murder verdict was given. One can't help but wonder in many of those cases if the child had been the one who died first and the death of the child had caused the death of the mother. Would the courts in our land say that he was guilty of first-degree murder for killing the child? Think about it. They've convicted him of what? Murder. I don't care if it's second degree or first degree. They've convicted him of committing murder. And the order in these things as it's pursued was because the mother was killed and the child died as a result of her death, then it's first degree in her case, second degree in the child's case. And what I'm asking is, what if the child had been the one he'd attacked and killed the child and the child's death had brought about the death of the mother? Would they say he was guilty of first degree murder for having killed the child and second degree murder for having the mother die as a result? Another question comes to mind. How can they convict him of murder at all? When you consider the laws, both in California and throughout the United States, imposed by the Supreme Court decision, how can they consider it even second degree murder? How can they consider it murder? When that very day in the state of California, untold hundreds of babies were killed. Now, we won't get the doctors and we won't get the mothers and others that are pro-abortion to answer that question very soon, I don't think. I want to stress to you, and I say this as forcefully as I know how, and I know I'm not going to have time to get to the other two points like I would like to, questions in this subject. In light of what was said yesterday, talking about government and the laws of the land, you and I need to be a people who let our voices be heard, but not our voices. I don't know how we can say it any clearer than we need to speak where the Bible speaks, even when it comes to matters such as this. Your opinion, my opinion, even the judges supreme on the Supreme Court, their opinion, will never overrule the opinion that God has expressed in His Word. And brethren, when we talk about abortion, we certainly will become emotional. I do, and I can't help it. But we never should try to use emotionalism to prove our case. We need to go to science, and it's developing all the time. But primarily, we need to take what the Bible teaches and show where science agrees with it, and then plead cases based on these matters as best we can. I would plead a case about staying longer, but it wouldn't do any good. The appeal would not be heard. But let me say this, and I'll get off of this subject. This particular passage, Exodus 21, if it teaches anything, it is, even in an accident, if a child's life is taken, capital punishment is the verdict. Rather than being an excuse for abortion, or somehow exegeting things in ways that should not, or more correctly stating it, eisegeting things and saying things are that are not there, we need to understand that what is there is, if you kill an unborn baby, and even if it is an accident, the Scriptures teach life for life. Now, in closing, let me just touch upon this point, if I may. Surveying the biased, unwarranted, prejudiced conclusions, and that's the only way I know how to say it, that some have drawn from Exodus 21, 22 through 25, one cannot help but ask the question, do the clear, concise, emphatic words and the encompassing, explicit context of this passage mean nothing? Brethren have been going around and preaching for years that some people will only say what they want the Bible to say rather than saying what the Bible really says. And there is no greater case than in this where people try to make the Bible say something it never would say in any way that it might be presented. Obviously, number one, the passage is discussing an accidental death or injury. A fact that no one should deny. Two, it does not take away from the other facts pertaining to one, the mother and the child. Two, their injuries and or their deaths. And three, the punishments to be imposed. That's what the verse has within it. It's talking about an accident. It's talking about an injury and or death. It's talking about a mother and child. And it's talking about the punishments to be rendered, depending on the degree of the seriousness of what's happened in the accident. Therefore, contextually speaking, there is no justification, one, for placing a greater value on the mother's life than that of her babies, two, for discounting the significance of the child's personhood, or three, for believing that there were two sets of punishments, one for injuring or killing the mother, and another set for injuring or killing the unborn. And you'll have to read the book to get some of the statements made by Brother Jackson and others when it comes to showing that the death penalty would be that which is prescribed for the death of the child. Now that I'm at the end, I want to have to confess that I wasn't real excited about which side of the veil the scepter was on, nor about the tabernacle or the tent, but you can read the book and you'll find what my views are on those things. I do want to thank everyone here for your kindness, for your attention, and I can't believe as many of you as did stayed awake for this lesson. By the way, we have a member of the church there at Southside that goes to sleep all the time on me. Last Sunday, I begged him. I said, please. It's Ron Keever, in case some of you might know. I begged him. I said, Ron, please stay awake while I'm trying to preach. He said, well, I managed to stay awake through the announcements. That's the only time you learn anything anyway. I asked him, I said, how much sleep do you get? He said, well, it kind of depends on how long you preach. So I guess that's that. Thank you.